From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Massachusetts U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz announced her resignation this week. She was the first woman and first Latina to hold the job.
I did smash that glass ceiling, and I'll tell you, I'm really proud of that fact.
We'll talk about that and other big stories in our Week in Review. Also today, the former chief editor of the Oxford English Dictionary on the serious job of defining our words.
Everyone feels the responsibility in the offices. I mean, I think they feel they're doing something of international importance. It's like playing for England at football, but you're on the staff of the OED.
And historian Jane Kamensky on the world of revolutionary Boston painter John Singleton Copley.
I think that the world probably felt something like this to Copley, where the future is very unclear.
That's next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday and time for our Week in Review, beginning with a new development in the long-running battle between the town of Dudley and the Islamic Society of Greater Worcester over a proposed cemetery. Today, they reached an agreement to build it.
This is a great day for Massachusetts, for the Dudley community, and for furtherance of understanding between various communities.
That's attorney Howard Cooper there, who represents the Islamic Society. The agreement allows the Islamic Society space for several thousand burial plots on 6 acres of property the group will now be allowed to purchase. Opposition to the Muslim cemetery had been so intense that it prompted a lawsuit and, separately, a U.S. attorney's civil rights investigation. So with us in the studio to talk about this and the rest of the week's big news is Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Good to see you, Tom.
Good to see you.
Happy holidays preemptively, I'm going to wish you here.
Thank you.
And also with us today is Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Arlene, happy early holidays and good to see you too.
Same here, Meghna.
All right, let me just get a first quick reaction from both of you about the fact that this very contentious battle in Dudley at least seems to have come to something of a conclusion. Tom, your take?
Well, it's good to see that finally Dudley do right.
Oh, wah, wah, wah.
Sorry about that. So I've been following this one for a while, and I think there was almost no question that if this had been a Catholic cemetery or a Jewish cemetery, you would not have seen this kind of reaction, this kind of issue heightened up so high. I do not know at this point who were the bad actors here in Dudley, whether it was just some citizens who were prejudiced or whether it really was the town government, but this went on way too long, ultimately had to go to court. It's good to see that, you know, quite frankly, in a season of joy and so on, that finally these people are able to come to some resolution.
Arlene, your thoughts?
Well, you know, it's been a sad series of events around this with a good conclusion today, thankfully. The ACLU spent a lot of time on this case. Howard Cooper, the ACLU attorney, Sarah Wunsch, the attorney general weighed in. As you mentioned, Carmen Ortiz's office weighed in. There were, in fact, many anti-Muslim statements that were made by folks in the course of the proceedings on this in the town of Dudley. Not all the people in Dudley felt that way. There were plenty of good, positive, open-minded, fair folks, but there were some real enmity and anti-Muslim sentiment that was discussed many a time. And,
Arlene, can I just jump in here? Because we have some tape from some of the Dudley Town meetings that were held when they were discussing the cemetery. Because neighbors earlier in this year had raised concerns. There was a range of concerns, some of them about the size and scale of the cemetery. Others had worries about potential drinking water contamination. But we've got some tape here from one of the town meetings. And in it, you're going to hear a Dudley resident, Jared Manzi. He had a different opinion, and again, this was at one of the meetings that drew many hundreds of people.
Why not go bury your dead at a Christian cemetery? Why do you need your own cemetery if you're willing to violate jihadi law?
So that was one view from a Dudley Town meeting earlier this year. But I have to say also that we have a tape here from Dudley Town Administrator Greg Baluconis. He spoke on behalf of the town selectman back in August, saying that he didn't think that the town was doing anything wrong.
The town feels as though it didn't violate anyone's religious rights, including the Islamic societies. And we don't feel that our practices discriminate against anyone on the basis of religion or religious denomination.
Well, Carmen Ortiz's office, you know, looked into that to see whether or not that was true. That made
That's
it national
right.
news. But Arlene, right. pick up your thought there.
Well, the fact of the matter is that the Islamic Society of Greater Worcester was put through more hurdles than anyone else would have been for seeking a cemetery. No one ever worries about the contamination of water for a Christian cemetery or for any other kind. So I think there were plenty of good people in Dudley who were trying to be, or in fact were, open-minded, but there were folks who were ill-intended from the start. And one of the attorneys at the ACLU, you know, contacted me today and said, you know, this is a great resolution, today's announcement, a great resolution in the Trump era of hostility towards Muslims.
I think that's right. I mean, I think this is just an isolated case, but it really does speak somewhat more large, you know, to kind of the larger issues we're going to be dealing with over the next few years. You know, are we really building walls? Are we really, you know, letting people in on the basis of religion or not? You saw in a little microcosm here in Dudley what some of that can lead to. And so I guess it's a good sign that in Dudley people were able to turn back that, quite frankly,
right.
bigoted tide.
And that a resolution was they did come to a resolution.
A seasonally appropriate resolution.
Right.
I do like actually hope the stories that end hopefully, especially at the end of this year. Well, but as we mentioned earlier, this got put into the national sort of news cycle, or got national attention was brought to it when U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz's office decided it was going to launch a civil rights investigation into what was happening in Dudley. One of the many high-profile things that Carmen Ortiz has done in her tenure as Massachusetts U.S. attorney, and this week she announced that she is stepping down from that post. Here she is speaking to WBZ-TV about the decision.
Now that my tenure is coming to an end, I feel that it is time for me to do other work. It was time for someone else to serve in this capacity.
So Ortiz was appointed by President Obama. She was the first woman and first Latina ever to hold the job. But she made a lot of news herself here in Massachusetts with the cases that she tried. So let me start with you, Tom, your take on Ortiz's tenure as U.S. attorney here.
So I think in general, we're going to think of her tenure as a really strong one. She took on some really high profile cases, the Bulger case, the Marathon bombings. She was certainly in the news an awful lot. I think the downside of her tenure had to do with some of the public corruption investigations. Mm-hmm. And I actually don't really fault her for doing that, because that's really the role of the feds. Within the state, you just don't see a lot of people really getting excited about investigating the people they work with. You need the feds to do this. But the problem that she had is several of those investigations really were leaning too hard on kind of weak federal law, and which is why she had a major one reversed just this week, which was with the probation department.
With the O'Brien case.
Yeah.
Yeah. Arlene, your thoughts?
Well, I think Tom's right. She's a bit of a mixed bag. She's done some very good work, but she has been uniformly, it seems, criticized for doing overzealous prosecutions and overreaching. And I agree on some of the public corruption cases were perfect examples where she did, in fact, in my opinion, overreach. The case, the probation scandal that Tom just mentioned, the Sal DeMacy case, seeking this extremely long sentence, perhaps even an inappropriate prosecution, many people think, not moving for a compassionate release years earlier. The Walsh administration going after two employees.
That's
still ongoing because they were trying to get union labor hired at some music festivals to do construction work in town. So for some of her less high-profile cases, I'm told that she made a lot of very good decisions, but a lot less so in the high-profile, media-driven ones.
But Tom says it's the job of the federal prosecutor to do
really
exactly
is.
This.
It's the job to go after things appropriately, but the question is if you're stretching federal law, interpretation of federal law.
Right. And so the probation department is actually a great example of that. I mean, when you saw that reversed by the federal court, you know, the federal court made it quite clear that what was going on probably was illegal under state law, just not illegal under federal law. And, you know, the regret there, to be frank, is that with that being reversed, people are going to think, oh, now it's fine to just do, you know, ignore personnel law, hire people on the basis of favoritism rather than merit. And that really should not be the lesson to be drawn out
of this. Well, also, okay, speaking of potential prosecutorial overreach, there's another case, the case of Aaron Swartz,
the internet activist.
Who he was arrested in 2011 for hacking a server of academic journals at MIT and making them public, charged with a felony. He later on ended up taking his own life, and many people said that was, you know, they wonder if it was due in part to Carmen Ortiz putting the full force of the U.S. Attorney's Office on him for what many see as not necessarily a felony-deserving charge.
Right, and she really has, I think, subsequently voiced some regret over her role in that. I mean, I think it's exactly right that that was something that should have been handled not through the criminal process, but in some other manner.
Mm. There is that one. And you're right. She has spoken of some regrets around that case. But even on the patronage case, you know, there have been a lot of statements, you know, from the courts that not all unappealing conduct is criminal. So you might not like patronage, but that doesn't mean that it is illegal. And, you know, she took the Bob DeLeo, named him as an unindicted co-conspirator. That hurt the man's reputation. For a very decent and thoughtful guy, by the way, but he and other legislators have lived for 6-7 years now under this cloud of suspicion. This is legal vindication for them, but that still hurt their reputations.
Yeah, he's certainly not happy that she's leaving. Well, unhappy, I should say.
Unhappy. Well, I want to play a little bit more tape from U.S. Attorney Ortiz here, because this comes in May 2015 at a press conference following the guilty verdict for Jahar Tsarnaev, the Boston Marathon bomber. I want to play it because it gives us a sense as to, you know, whether you're a critic of her or a supporter of her take of the purpose and how the purpose of the law and how the law should be enacted.
Even in the wake of horror and tragedy, we are not intimidated by acts of terror or radical ideals. On the contrary, the trial of this case has showcased an important American ideal that even the worst of the worst deserve a fair trial and due process of law.
So that was U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz in May of 2015. But let me ask both of you, the question now is, who is going to be her successor? Who's going to be the new Massachusetts U.S. attorney? Because usually it's, what, the governor or a senator that would recommend who that person should be to the president?
But sounds like patronage to me.
Recommend. But right now we have two Democratic senators and a governor who we're told that the president-elect hasn't asked the Baker administration for any help in identifying potential candidates. So
yeah, I don't think we're going to be getting Charlie Baker having a lot of influence on the Trump administration for quite some time. Given that he refused to vote for Trump and was very vocal about that. So there's a number of possible people out there. I wonder if Michael Sullivan might come back.
Wow. I've wondered the same thing, actually, the way he's been out there.
Have we had U.S. attorneys have second takes at it?
I don't know, but, you know, there's always time for a first.
Okay. Well, we spoke about the actual Boston Marathon bombing and the trial of Jahar Tsarnaev under Ortiz's tenure. I want to shift gears here and talk about a fictional take on that actual event that happened here in Massachusetts, because the new movie, Patriots Day, was released this week. It stars Mark Wahlberg, Bostonian Mark Wahlberg. And let's play a clip here. This is a scene where Wahlberg's character, he plays a Boston police officer, and he's arguing for the release of photos that law enforcement had of the two people who were then the suspected bombers.
Right now, Boston's working against us. Yeah, that's normal. You got a murder, no one rats. We don't got that problem. Because in this city, when it comes to terrorism, everybody wants to talk. You release the photos of our guys, sit back and listen. Trust me. You got to start letting Boston work for us. I'm telling you.
That's a scene from Patriots Day starring Mark Wahlberg. It's got a whole variety of reviews. Ty Burr at The Globe basically said, at best, it's, quote, unnecessary. At worst, it's vaguely insulting.
Ouch.
What do you think?
Ouch. It's a little harsh, but I understand the sentiment. You know, I listened to Wahlberg talk about the film and why he made it, and one of the lines he's repeated several times now, which I think is quite legitimate, he said someone was going to make the movie, and no matter what. And they might have exploited it more, or exploited, period, and then I'm saying more. So to the extent that that was going to happen, you know, the nature of these things is that artistic license allows you to make composite characters, as some critics have been unhappy with, putting, you know, embodying in one policeman who happened to be played by Wahlberg the all the brilliant insights and being at all the important scenes and moments in the drama. But that artistic license is always somewhat painful for some of the people involved. There was the police officer, Dennis D.J. Simmons, who, you know, died from his injuries a year later. Mm-hmm. It's got to be very painful to his family, right? Yeah. There have been articles about that, and for his not even being mentioned in passing in the film. Films like this will always leave out important details, as do, quite frankly, the books. You know, in the same-sex marriage debate, since it happened in Massachusetts, there've been, and across the country, there have been a number of pieces of nonfiction written, and each and every one of them has been controversial because they don't include X, Y, and Z, or they omit this, or they make this appear the wrong way. So the recording of history is always challenging.
Right. Before we get to you, Tom, I just want to play a little bit more tape, because Arlene had mentioned how Mark Wahlberg said someone was going to make it, so it best that it was him because he has some fealty to Boston, being from Dorchester. He told us at Radio Boston that he really felt a sense of responsibility.
If anybody is going to be held accountable in this community, it's me. Yeah. Everybody else can kind of go back to their homes in California, wherever else. You know, I come here to visit my mom. I want to go to the Boys Club. I want to go to my neighborhood, and I want to be able to hold my head up and you know, walk the streets with pride.
Tom, I'm curious. I mean, I don't object and I don't dispute Wahlberg's own sense of personal responsibility here, but also, like, it's Hollywood. They're making money off of this about things that actually happen to real people who live in our community.
Right. I mean, if Mark Wahlberg saying a local has to make it then raises the question, why'd he make the movie about Deepwater Horizon? You know, I mean, it's kind of an absurd argument. Yes, someone was going to make it, and probably, by the way, someone's going to make another version of it. In fact, another version is being made of it. We're going to see several movies about this. There's going to be a lot of money made, and looks like there's going to be a lot of money made out of this one as well. I have not seen the movie, so I hesitate to sort of try to judge what's going on here, but everything I have read about it, and the most offensive thing about it really is this notion that the Mark Wahlberg fictional character is there at every turning point, as Arlene said. And I think one of the things that really misses is the sort of chaotic nature of the entire process, that it was, if we got to this solution, we got to the capture through the actions of a lot of individual men and women rather than one character who somehow was able to tie the whole thing together.
Right. And I mean, there was since we all lived it, we know that there's so many complexities and controversial things that happened in the course of that week. The whole notion of having to had that shelter in place on the day of the Watertown manhunt. I don't think they really accurately explore what the true ramifications of that decision were. And that Tsarnaev was just found a couple hundred yards from where he had last been seen. I mean, there's a lot going on there. But I'm wondering, I mean, I'll go out there and I'll just put out my opinion there. I don't adore the idea of this movie. I don't really love it when Hollywood does, especially in close proximity in time, fictionalize real tragedies. But on the other hand, it's not necessarily Hollywood's duty to be a factual record keeper. So, you know, they're doing what they do best. But do you ever get concerned, Arlene, that there's this idea that for many people who didn't live through it or any historical event that's depicted in Hollywood, that it, in a way, even though it's not meant to be, it kind of becomes a de facto part of the record?
That's exactly what I worry about. And I know that I've fallen prey to it. I love historic dramas. I've watched lots of them. And how many times am I sitting assuming that certain things are fact when, in fact, they're artistic license? I worry about that terrifically for this issue, for this moment, for this event, but for many others. And, you know, your producer, Jamie Maloney, said that we all have these painful real images in our heads about what happened that day. For me, it was very emotional. You know, I was in a total panic. Where are my kids? Are they at the finish line? Are their friends there? In fact, we knew people who were hurt, some very badly. And you want that to be honored and you want it to be respected, but you know it will never come out exactly accurately.
Yeah. The difference between kind of just a movie and a good film is that somehow the good film gives you an additional sense of perspective on something. It illuminates something. It's not clear that this illuminates more rather than just telling a good yarn, if you will.
Well, we have just enough time to wrap up This Week in Review with our hubbubs. Some hopefully lighter news, or maybe news that didn't make the top of the fold, as they say. So, Tom, you want to give us your hubbub?
It's not lighter news, but okay. Earlier this month, a junior at Tufts University wrote this horrifying first-person account of hazing, sexual misconduct, homophobia, and racial discrimination at one of the campus's fraternities. In response, the school's administration has now embarked on an investigation to see how Greek life can be reformed. My opinion, that's not going to be good enough. The entire idea of Greek life is inherently contrary to the values one would expect of higher education. It's exclusionary, not only on the basis of sex, but also of race, ethnicity, economics, and demographics. Moreover, fraternities and sororities breed a narrow-minded culture of insularity at a place whose mission should be the exact opposite. Forget reform. Instead, it's time, as some former members of a Tufts sorority urged this week, to abolish Greek life altogether.
Tell us how you really feel.
Yes.
Yeah, really.
And ladies and gentlemen, it's Tom Keene. You're at Tom Keene, right?
You got it.
Okay. Not at Radio Boston, at Tom Keene. All right. Well, so Tom coming out strong on his opinion about Greek life here. Arlene, your hubbub.
I'm going to give us a lighter touch. I'm going to pivot from the usual hubbub to a more seasonal perspective that's not news-oriented, which is that 'tis the season of the year to try and reach for our higher selves, to think about the world as it could and should be, about the blessings that we have, about the ways in which we can help people with less good fortune. There is a rabbi at Temple Israel who often says that you should pray like everything depends on God, but, and this is the important line, but act like everything depends on you. So today I say how grateful I am for friends and family and neighbors writ large, as well as the many good fortunes I've enjoyed. But at the risk of sounding Pollyanna-ish, I will share a gentle reminder in this post-election season, which is being negative is infectious, but so too is the opposite. Being kind, thoughtful, caring encourages other people to do likewise, and it can be extraordinarily powerful. So in these very challenging times, my hope for us all is that we can all be a little better to each other in the coming year, so that when someone encourages us to go low, we manage to find a way to go high in our responses. And let's use this time of year to encourage ourselves, myself included, to listen to our better angels. So I'm wishing all our listeners the very best for the coming year.
Arlene, that was beautiful.
That was nice. Beautiful.
I'm going to change my hubbub right now. No, seriously, my hubbub is going to be that I hope everyone hearing that, and I'm including myself, takes it to heart and puts it to practice in 2017. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, with that, happy New Year and happy holidays to both of you. It's been great having you in the studio all the many times you've both come this year. I'm so happy and so grateful. You're part of the Radio Boston family, and I wish you both the very, very best of the holiday season.
And a happy new year.
Tom,
same here.
I'm going to give you your proper sign-off now. Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti page, and Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus, two of our favorite folks who come in to help us out with the Week in Review. And thanks to all of our other Week in Review members as well who've come in all of this very difficult and long and newsworthy year. Look forward to seeing you all again next year. But that's it for this Week in Review. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Oxford English Dictionary is one of the world's most beloved dictionaries. It's also very, very big. The second edition, completed in 1989, has 20 volumes, 20,000 pages, with entries for nearly 300,000 words. The OED, as it's affectionately known in shorthand, has been going since 1879, and it's continuously updated. In the last quarter of 2016, nearly 500 words, sub-entries, and senses were added to the venerable catalog. John Simpson is one of the OED's longest-serving chief editors. He held the post for 20 of his 37 years on the dictionary's staff. He retired in 2013, and Simpson's penned a new memoir of his time at the OED. It's called The Word Detective, searching for the meaning of it all at the Oxford English Dictionary. We spoke with Simpson earlier and began by asking him if he had loved words his entire life.
Looking back on it, because you don't know at the time you think everything's perfectly normal, I quite liked classifying things. And it doesn't mean I collected stamps or anything. But I was interested in... I never read novels until I was about, I don't know, 10, 12 or something like that. I was always going to the library and getting books about dinosaurs, getting factual things. So I think... And I used to read the Guinness Book of World Records till I knew most of it. I mean, lots of kids are like that. And then eventually I also got to see The Beauties of Fiction. And I sort of merged them together in lexicography because in some ways writing a definition is being sort of creative like an author as well as drawing facts together. So I think it was a perfect upbringing to become a lexicographer.
And at what point in time did lexicography really speak out to you and become the path that your career would take?
It was a path that was directed my way by an advert that my that Hillary, who became my wife, saw in the newspapers, thinking I should maybe have some money to support myself. And so she found me a job, thought it might be interesting. And I think looking back that she must have thought I was a fairly strange sort of person to be the person that wanted that job. But I applied for it and actually I thoroughly enjoyed it. I never regretted a minute I was there over 37 years.
So from the outside, there are so many people who, you know, who own the OED, whether in its multi-volume incarnation or I actually own the one that's all in one volume and you have to use a magnifying glass to read the entries.
Yeah.
But it is the, you know, it is the Bible of the English language and it's held as this, you know, the gold standard in terms of how we understand the development and usage of words in the English language. Is it felt that way within the offices of the OED?
I think everyone feels a responsibility in the offices. I mean, I think they feel they're doing something of international importance. It's like playing for England at football, but you're on the staff of the OED. It's that sort of...
For far less pay, I guess.
Yeah, I'm afraid so, yeah. But you don't get so muddy. You know it's an important job. You know it needs doing. You know you're very fortunate the university press is funding you to do it. And I couldn't imagine doing anything else.
Yeah. So, of course, for every word that's in the OED, there's a historical explanation of when it first appeared in the language and a little bit about its development over time. And then, of course, there's the definition itself. And you have some delightful stories of how some words, their final definition was put into the Oxford English Dictionary. For example, the word skanking.
Oh, yeah, that's right. we'd found in our index cards, because this is going back to the 1990s, that there were a lot of examples for this word skanking, and it was clearly a kind of Caribbean dance, and our project was to describe it for the dictionary. Well, I didn't know, our academic advisors didn't know what it mean, and it happened that I was at a television program as a guest with a guy called a British performance poet called Benjamin Zephaniah, and so I took the opportunity of asking him what skanking meant, and he looked at me in a very strange way, in the way that people often look at lexicographers, and he said, "Well, I know what it is, but I don't actually really know the sort of. I never thought of actually having to write down what it meant before. So what I'll do is, rather than try to tell you what it means, I'll come to your office next time in Oxford and I'll skank for you." And he did. About a month later, I got a phone call from Benjamin saying, I'm coming over now to I've got a performance in Bristol, the other side of Oxford. I'll stop off on the way. And he came along. We cleared an area out in front of my desk. And he stood in front of it and he started very embarrassed to start with. And after a couple of minutes, he was getting into it. And he was, I can't demonstrate on radio, but he was throwing his arms everywhere and explaining in general what skanking meant. And anybody who was going past my window in Oxford at the time would have seen a sort of a bravura performance of this Caribbean art, which then helped me write the definition and move on to the next word.
The word skanking then appears in the Oxford English Dictionary as a style of West Indian dancing to reggae music in which the body bends forward at the waist and the knees are raised and the hands claw the air in time to the beat, dancing in this style.
Benjamin explained to it a bit like cleaning windows, but I didn't put that into the definition.
Did you happen to try it out when he was there?
I didn't know. I'm not a big dancer of Caribbean music. To Caribbean music, but no, I didn't.
So in the book, you have a wonderful description of what lexicography is. And you write, lexicography is pretty sharp-edged. There's no place for wobbly or brittle thinking. You see a problem and leap in to solve it. You don't wallow it, indulging yourself in the beauties of the language. Now, I found this to be very interesting because I suppose a casual observer might think that it's exactly the opposite, that by definition you are wallowing in the beauties of the English language.
If you let yourself do that, then you can't analyse the text. We're analysts, we're language analysts, we're language historians. There's a bit in the book where I talk about a classic section of Jane Eyre, I think, and I say that if you allow yourself to follow the story and get excited by the climax of Jane Eyre, you actually miss the fact that there are some quite important dictionary observations that you can make about the words that the author's using, which most people won't worry about. But, you need to if you're a lexicographer. It takes you about 5 years from when you first join to when you can actually read something sensibly again.
Now, John Simpson, I wonder if we might just sort of take a little turn here, because this is a memoir. You are writing the story of not just your time at the OED, but your experience and your family's experience as well. And there is a very moving part of the book, of the memoir, when you write about how one of your two daughters, Ellie, who is nonverbal, she's now, what, in her 20s?
She's 26 now, yeah, but she has a developmental age of 1.5, probably. I mean, she walks around. She's very friendly. She's very happy. Sits a lot of time on the sofa, or likes sitting in cars and seeing things passing her by. But she's not proactive herself. She likes responding to things. We don't know it's something genetic. We don't know what the issue is. But it was curious all the time she was growing up. And coming back from work each day and wondering whether she'd said her first word, and she never did, and she never will, really. And the mixture between that and trying to understand her communication needs, by gesture or whatever, or developing a whole new language for communication with her at a very low level, compared to the sort of buzzy, creative, language-orientated people that I had that I met at work every day, and in the rest of the family as well.
Well, I wonder if your relationship with your daughter, has it made you think differently about the primacy of verbal communication as a means of communication?
It's difficult to say, because it's just made me much more aware of the issues of verbal communication when it's not normal. And I'm not sure I can say very much more than that, but it just takes you down paths that I wouldn't otherwise have had to go, which I think is good for me and good for everyone. One of the things about Ellie is that she's good for everyone who meets her, because they have to realign their sort of thoughts and emotions for her.
Yeah. So in this section where you write about Ellie, you also do something that you do in other places in the book, and that is you sort of take a momentary aside, because you do this frequently in the book, where you'll write a sentence and then in boldface type, one of the words will be put in boldface, and then you take this aside and sort of write the story of that word. And in this case, in the book, in the sentence, it was only later, though, that the full extent of Ellie's disability became clear. You take us on one of those asides in terms of the uses and origins of the word disability itself. Mm. It's a fascinating story. Can you tell us that?
Yeah, and I went on to talk about handicap as well.
Yeah.
Because disability is what was a term the professionals were using, but we knew from the past that they tended to talk about handicap.
I mean, you say the first record of the term dates to 1545.
Yeah, it comes through at a time when people are understanding the empirical nature of their knowledge, and so they want new vocabulary to describe that sort of expressions. Yeah.
Well, but in this section, though, you end with a very provocative thought. You write that disability has a negative prefix, so maybe it, too, will have a relatively short shelf life. However the vocabulary changes, we need to remember words as tinderboxes of their time.
Mm.
What did you mean by that?
Well, I meant by that we have, if we take a word like handicap or a word like disability, we need to understand that there's nothing at the time wrong with the words, but they're part of a set of words which give you an impression of how society was at that time. Mm. So the sort of society which promotes the word disability is a different sort of society than promotes the words handicap. And it's good if people can understand that there are changes in society over periods, because we forget so much. And I think the link between language and society is a good way of remembering what we may have forgotten of the past.
Yeah. Well, John Simpson is the author of the memoir, The Word Detective, Searching for the Meaning of It All at the Oxford English Dictionary. He spent 37 years working at the OED, and he was its chief editor from 1993 to 2013. John Simpson, thank you so very much. It was a real pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghan Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. John Singleton Copley painted the portraits of some of Boston's most famous revolutionaries and founding fathers: John Hancock, Paul Revere, John Adams, Samuel Adams. Jane Kamensky says that's one of the reasons Copley is considered a quintessential great American painter.
In the United States, and especially in New England, we have, I think, what can only be called a nationalistic claim on him. There's a mind's eye picture of America that goes to his work and his particular kind of realism.
But there's a twist. The painter who so ably captured the spirit of revolutionary America may not have considered himself American at all. That's one of the questions at the heart of Jane Kamensky's new book, A Revolution in Color: The World of John Singleton Copley. We met up with Kamensky recently at the Harvard Art Museum to talk about Copley's life and see some of his portraits. She told us he was born on July 3rd, 1738, the son of Irish immigrants to Boston, which at the time was a hub of shipping activity on the periphery of the British Empire. Kamensky also says Copley became an artist almost by accident.
The likeliest ingredient is that when his mother, who was long widowed, remarried, Copley was 10, she happened to marry somebody who was a portraitist and engraver. And he had tools. Peter Pelham, Copley's stepfather, only was in Copley's life for 3 years. Copley was 10 when Pelham joined the family, or when the family combined, and 13 when Pelham died. So to the extent there was an art scene in Boston, it came home to Copley for three of the years that any lower middling boy would have been seeking a trade.
This is always one of the things that fascinates me so much about, you know, 17th and 18th century portraitists who we now consider great artists, is mm-hmm. that they very much have a story like Copley's.
Yes, it's not a lowly trade. It's not working the docks, although he
middling,
grew up on
right?
the docks.
Yeah.
Lower middling, I would say. He writes a quite famous letter where he says one of the things that make him want to get out of this provincial world is that the arts are no more esteemed than trades like shoemaking.
Well, I mean, since we're standing in front of three of his works, can we talk about them?
Yeah.
So three Boylstons here, right?
So this is a trio of family portraits with the mother in the center and two brothers flanking her on either side. It's a mercantile family, which is exactly the kind of family that wanted themselves commemorated in portraiture. They're all a very, very high level of finish, almost as if Copley was holding up a mirror to his subjects. There's a real sort of warts and all unidealized quality to the way that Copley captures faces. I think one of the questions about his early career is, how does he paint better than anything he's ever seen?
Uh-huh.
And he does. So all three of these have that hyper-realistic quality. The fabrics are especially vivid. Like, you almost want to touch Nicholas Boylston's gown and see if the damask feels raised or flocked. You can see the older Mrs. Boylston's faint mustache.
Do you know why one of her hands is gloved and the other isn't?
It's giving her something to do.
Okay.
She's holding a glove. It's showcasing his excellence with fabric and with hands. But if you look closely at Mrs. Boylston's arm, there's a big anatomical flaw in the portrait. She looks like she's about to pull off her left forearm and beat you with it, right? I think one interesting thing that these canvases show is there's no drawing school in Boston, normal social interaction that would let you stare at a nude model. So when he's rendering anatomy, he's working with a figure. He, you know, one of those little jointed wooden figures. He, one of the first things he does for himself, he's copying medical illustration books. He's copying a plaster copy of a marble copy of the Venus de Milo. That's the kind of game of telephone of the arts. So when you see a painter who is this skilled not being able to attach an arm to the body, it tells us something about the conditions of production there.
So around the time that he was painting these portraits, I see this one is 1767 here. I mean, who were Copley's artistic contemporaries, and what made him really stand out from them?
His early life is marked by a series of tragedies. His father dies, his stepfather dies. The best artist in Boston, who's an Edinburgh-trained portraitist named John Smybert, also dies. So there's not a lot of artistic means around him, but this also creates space so that when the Seven Years' War happens and a lot of people from the empire are using Boston as a hub of provisioning, of battle planning, of place seeking and office holding and sort of strategies for climbing the rungs of the empire, portraiture is one of those strategies. Picture of yourself wrapped in red. He's the best thing in town by accident. He's still a teenager, and there's nobody around really crafting this trade that can compete with him.
He was so young when he was doing these paintings.
He was so young, yeah. I mean, his, you know,
that's amazing.
And this is another part of the lower middling echelon, is that when his stepfather dies and he's 13, he's got a mother who is 50, sells a little tobacco. He's got a half-brother who is 3. He's got need. So by 15, he has a practice in portraiture where people who are not family members are coming and paying him. And by the time he's 20, he's done something that none of his male kin have done in the so-called New World. He's bought a house.
Wow. Now, do I have this right that he has a family connection to the Tea Party, the Boston Tea Party?
Yes, so, you know, at the time that these portraits were painted, it's sort of in the middle of the long run of up and down imperial tensions. So 1767, it's a relatively calm moment when he's doing these portraits. Flare up with the occupation of Boston in 1768, calms down again. Flare up with the massacre, even after the so-called massacre, calms down again. So when the Tea Act is passed in 1773, various merchants in Boston think, this is a fantastic economic opportunity. You know, instead of competing with the smugglers, I can get a license to sell this soft drug. And one of the people who succeeds in getting those licenses is Copley's father-in-law. So he marries a political identity that could not possibly have been foreseen when he made what I've described as the most deliberate and important choice of his life, approaching the altar in 1769. So when the tea ships sail into Boston in December of 1773, it's Copley's father-in-law's tea. And the kin, the wider kin network, really do become persona non grata after the end of 1773. They are, at the time of the Tea Party, they're in exile in the island fortress in the middle of the harbor, Castle William. Threats are published in the papers if they dare show their faces in town. One of the things that his life shows us, I think, that we too often forget, is that our revolution is a violent birth for this country, not a war of ideas on paper alone, but also a war in the streets. And one man's tea party was another man's terror. And for Copley's kin, it was terror. House attacks by night and particular kinds of yells and stone throwing and tar and feathering. And Copley's kin was on the brunt of it, even though they were not people of strong political loyalties. They really were, like most people, thinking quite pragmatically about self-interest, and they bet wrong.
And then they had to leave.
Copley left Boston in June of 1774, 10 days after the so-called Intolerable Acts, including the Boston Port Act, closed the port. So he got out while he could. He left his entire family behind, walked away from them all, I think, not knowing on which side of the ocean they would or should reunite. You know, he left with the idea of going from the edge of this empire into its center, and it seems pretty clear that it was always his hope that he would make it in the big city, which of course was London. So he said in later life, he says, you know, I left long before the war broke out, not for political reasons, you know, before anyone could have anticipated what happened, for the purpose of studying art. This is both true and false.
So looking here at these paintings again and the descriptions that go along with them, I noticed that, and it's not just here at the Harvard Art Museums, but everywhere where Copley's hang, underneath the name John Singleton Copley, it says American.
Yeah.
Would he have quibbled with that? Because you were talking about how we've laid claim to him.
I think he meant, certainly at the time he left, he meant American in the way that we would speak of being from New England. So that it's a regional identity. One would certainly have used it in Jamaica as well as in Massachusetts. In the world of his birth, British American hyphenated would have been a common term into the Seven Years' War. So American as a collective identity is sort of coming into being in these years in the 1760s, which proved to be such problematic years for somebody like Copley, who is attached to the seamless British world of his birth. So he might have called himself regionally an American. He had enough foresight at the time he left to believe that the Americans, who he begins referring to as people over there, that the Americans would win. So he knows that they are taking on a sort of proto-national identity, and if there is war, they will not back down, because he has seen them not back down.
For decades prior to
for a good decade, yeah. He has seen the world of the middle ground, which is the place where a tradesman lives, right? Just fall away like a trapdoor opening. And I think what American comes to mean winds up on one side of that trapdoor, and the sort of British American falls through it, and he winds up as a British artist.
Now, you call it, the subtitle of your book is A Revolution in Color.
In color, which I mean in two ways. One, of course, is the color trades, but I also want us to see the revolution in more shades of color than we often do, not with white-hatted patriots and black-hatted Tories doing combat over an obvious set of divisions. The divisions emerge, they're not obvious, and there are many people like Copley, in fact, probably most people, in the uneasy middle between those two sides.
So now, of course, we have to ask. I mean, we're having this conversation after there's been this massive political act, transformation. Yeah. Some people are even calling it a revolution with the presidential election. I mean,
I think that the world probably felt something like this to Copley, where there's a sudden sea change that seems to demand a new level of side choosing, and where the future is very unclear. You know, Copley's America did not have robust democratic institutions. Democracy was, for most people in his place and time, an insult. But the idea of the temperature of life suddenly going from a sustainable 98.6 to 105 degrees, I think would have been very familiar after, you know, I think the Tea Party really is the moment where there is no turning back. John Adams in his diary calls the Tea Party famously, you know, so bold, so intrepid that it cannot be but seen as an epoca in history. A sentence after that, he says, there are many people who would like to see as many bodies floating face down in the harbor as there are chests of tea. And he was talking about Copley's father-in-law. So a world that seems polite and then bursts into a new level of vitriol, I think is very much how that moment felt to Copley.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us here at the Harvard Art Museums about John Singleton Copley, and I mean, look, what goes around comes around in history. We can never learn about it enough, I think. So
yeah,
thank
well,
you.
The problem is that we can only live forward, and historians can only see backwards. So here we are facing forward into an uncertain future, just as everybody who we ever study does, and it's humbling to remember that.
Jane Kamensky is a professor of history at Harvard, and her new book is A Revolution in Color, The World of John Singleton Copley. That's it for today and this week. Have a happy, a healthy, and safe holiday season. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.